joining me. I've been spending a lot of time the last few years in Richmond, California, which is seen by industry and a lot of other people as a sacrifice zone, just a place of a lot of refineries and pollution, and who cares about the people who live there. But I'm going up to Vancouver this week to talk to people about the pipelines that are being proposed to go across the mountains from the tar sands to then feed tankers, super tankers that will take the oil to California and over to Asia. And Vancouver sees itself as a sacrifice zone. And so there's this concept that we can just throw away parts of the world, that they don't matter because it's more important to industrialize. And what does that say to you about those severance, I guess, that people who perceive that sacrifice zones are a necessity, how does that show what their relationship to the rest of the planet is?
You know, if we think that sacrifice zones are a necessity for continuing life as we know it, then we've got to examine the kind of lifestyle that we're leaving, or that we're I say that we're living, but I actually did mean that we're leaving. It's unsustainable if you think that you have to tear it apart in order for the rest of us to thrive. It's a real issue of justice, isn't it? Justice as between communities, where some people would take whatever they want to enrich themselves and foist off the costs on people who have relatively little voice, including people of the future.
Well, I had a conversation with this man in Vancouver who's been working to stop the tar sands and working along to protect forests and a lot of other things. And we were talking about the two pipelines that are being proposed across BC. And when we go to Kitimat in northern BC, relatively, well, mostly except for the town of Kitimat itself, a very pristine area that's still the home to all kinds of wildlife that's been extirpated from the rest of North America, as well as to real traditional ways of the First Nations people there. The other pipeline would go to Vancouver. And this guy was telling me that we were talking about the icon of the wolf and that being the icon for Kitimat. And he said, well, we're trying to show that there's also the icon of the orca whale down here in Vancouver, that we don't want to see ourselves as a sacrifice zone. And so there's this interesting thing where I think environmentalists have to look at, why is it just as important to protect urban areas that still have natural areas around them as much as it is to protect the very pristine wilderness areas like the Great Bear Rainforest in northern BC?
I think it's important to protect it all to the extent that we can. Our tendency is to think that where I live is the one that needs to be protected. I've been up to the Kitimat area. It is extraordinarily beautiful, and it is in some way the heart of that ecosystem. And there's just no way of separating out the wilderness from the urban. We are deeply interconnected, and the damage that we do outside our cities comes back to haunt us. If we damage a river, we'll be ultimately drinking that water. If we poison the air, we'll ultimately be breathing it. So the distinctions that we draw are not the distinctions that the earth would have us think about.
Well, are you familiar with the book that Ursula Le Guin wrote many years ago, The Word for World is Forest, which is a book about seeing, it's actually a Gaia notion, where seeing this planet, they discover this planet, and it turns out that the entire planet is one living organism. But the earthlings who come to colonize the planet, actually, this is what I was thinking about sacrifice zones, there's this area that they completely trash out, and it cannot be restored. But after that, they've learned the lesson, and it kind of, there's an enlightenment that unfolds, and they understand the interconnections of nature. But I was thinking about that area, that planet, that could never be restored, and that's kind of the ultimate sacrifice zone. What do we do to see? We want to prevent as many as possible. But when we have them, what do we do with these areas that really are not able to be restored to anything close to their original naturalness?
One of my friends is a member of the Onondaga Nation. They have a sacred lake edge where the law was given to them. That sacred land is now under 20 feet of industrial sludge. And the effort to restore it has been paltry. It's been unconscionably reckless. And what those people are doing is they are making that into a sacred zone again, and they are dancing and feasting on that land. They are not willing to say that this is no longer a sacred place. What they are saying is that we will restore the sacredness of this place by our gratitude, by our dancing, by our celebration, by our refusal to let it go, and by our refusal to let people consider it simply a profanity.
Well, actually, I understand that these places can be restored. It just takes a long time. But I think what it also takes a long time is to is to build a community resource like KABU, where we've been around for 45 years, and we are in the middle of a pledge drive, and we're trying to raise, I do believe it's $97,000 by the end of Wednesday, to help us to keep this amazing institution going. It's because of having community radio that we can have someone like Kathleen Dean Moore on, and she drove up from Corvallis this morning to be live with us here as opposed to by phone, and we really appreciate that. And you can do your part right now to become part of this incredible community treasure and resource by calling 877-500-5266. And I have Justin on the other side of the air booth for me. We can kind of wave to each other through two windows. Hi, Justin.
Hi, Barbara.
So how's it going out there?
We're doing very well. I want to thank Amira in Southeast Portland for renewing her membership. Thank you so much. And there's always room for more of you aboard the mighty 90.7. And you can call and introduce yourself at 877-500-5266. If you could start or renew your membership at the $60 level, we can give you a copy of Moral Ground, Ethical Action for a Planet in Peril by Kathleen Dean Moore and Michael P. Nelson. And that will come into your hands, dear listeners, when you call up and introduce yourself. Toll free, 877-500-5266. You know, just a modest goal, Barbara, $500 for this program, and there are thousands of people listening. Maybe four of them could start that sustaining membership at $10 a month. That amounts to 33 cents a day towards the more than $2,000 a day it costs to keep this vital community resource serving everyone. 877-500-5266.
Or you can also go online to kboo.fm and you can click on the tip jar and become a member that way. When you become a member of KABU, you're not just supporting this radio station, you're actually supporting the entire community. Because as Justin was talking, I was thinking about all the different community groups and voices that we bring to you that feel that KABU is their most vital link to be able to get their message out, to be able to reach their constituencies, to be able to organize their events. And so supporting KABU is a real multiplying factor. Your $10 a month or $5 a month or $25 a month or whatever you'd like to give us, or $40 a year, we're pretty open about what we'll accept. We want it to be affordable to you. We also want you to think about giving us as much as you possibly feel that you can part with, because we are such a vital part of the network and the community that you're a part of. But when you give that money, it's not just going to keep this radio station going, it's actually going to keep our whole community going. And if you are like me and you drive around with a bumper sticker that says Keep Portland Weird, I think KABU is one of the greatest forces that's helped to keep Portland weird, that's helped to keep Portland local, that's helped to keep Portland a part of it's its own entity. And KABU is a strong voice for Portland.
Weird and wired, Barbara. Weird and wired. You know, I often ask people to remember that we are an electronic bulletin board, and we are serving out all this information around all the other social change activism that's going on. And you are absolutely right that all of that gets supported when you support KABU. It's the public airwaves and it's public information. Without that access point, it doesn't mean anything to say that the public owns the airwaves. So please make sure that you've put your money down, just a little bit of money down, on making sure we have access to the public's own airwaves. Toll free, 877-500-5266. $60 gets a copy of Kathleen Dean Moore's book, Moral Ground. It gets it into your hands right now. I'm going to hand it back to Barbara, but remind you that there are a couple lines open and there's always room for more of you aboard the mighty 90.7. 877-500-KBOO.
Or you can also go to kboo.fm on the web and click on the tip jar. This morning, we're talking with Kathleen Dean Moore, who is an environmental philosopher and essayist. She lives in Corvallis and was affiliated for quite a long time with Oregon State University. And we're talking this morning about some of the really knotty moral issues and ethical issues involved with trying to move us into a future which is less beholden to the carbon culture. One of the things that struck me, Kathleen, when we were talking last month, was you described yourself as being formerly part of Oregon State University. So I want to talk a little bit about why you left academia.
I don't think of myself as having left academia as much as having left the university. And I left there because universities, as wonderful as they are, move very slowly, and we don't have time. We don't have time to contemplate the prospect of climate change. It is on us. It's dangerous. It has begun. And my my effort in leaving the university was to leave behind very slow processes and see if I could find another way to make my voice heard over these very strong and rising winds.
I'm thinking, as you're talking about speeding up the processes, I'm working on this documentary about the tar sands, and I've been editing interviews I did with oil industry representatives in Calgary last summer, and they're talking about ways that they are improving their ability to reclaim these vast swaths of land the size of Seattle that they have been doing open pit mining with. And so they've actually reclaimed, I guess, 1% of the landscape that they have tortured. But they talk about speeding up the process of reforesting it and growing faster forests. And I just thought the whole idea of like growing faster forests, and this is a way we can deal with all the devastation that we do, which gets us to the whole idea of like geoengineering. So my guest last week was talking about all the people that are capitalizing on climate change, and perhaps the area that fascinates me and confuses me the most is the whole concept of geoengineering, where you can just go ahead and ravage the planet and then we'll find an engineering fix for it. What's your response to that?
Well, to the geoengineering, I would respond that that strikes me as part of the same comic book scenario. You know, who needs a way to escape the danger when we have technologies? And what geoengineering concerns me about the most is this notion that we can continue to live as we have, we can continue to profit as we have, and as it has in the past, the technology will come along and keep us from reaping the consequences of what we do. So this is sort of a notion of once again trying to make the terrible wreckage of the world risk-free for those of us who are reaping the profits.
Well, another interesting thing that my guest said last week is, well, there's all winners and losers in this whole game of profiting off of climate change. And a lot of countries like Canada are really scrambling to be on the winner side, which probably explains both their trying to grab territory along the shores of the soon-to-be ice-free Arctic Ocean so that they can get the first dibs on oil exploration rights, and also that the way that they're going after extracting as much bitumen from the tar sands areas in Alberta as they possibly can. But he also talks about, and there's also this issue of fences, is the first world is building fences to keep the rest of the world out. And so it depends on which side of the fence you are, whether you're a winner or you're a loser. So from the perspective of the losers, how do you see the winners?
Let me pick up the part of your question that has to do with people who are making a profit, capitalizing on the changes that climate change is wrecking on the world. There's really two moral problems with that. The first one has to do with, it's very pragmatic, very utilitarian. You'll remember the scripture that says, "For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also." So the possibilities of making a fortune off of wrecking the world increases the number of people who are fans of that undertaking, and people who are rooting for it, and people who are literally invested in the wreckage of the world. So there's that. But there's also a deeply moral problem, a problem of virtue ethics there too. Ethical considerations are a trump card that trumps economic argument. We say, well, we could make a lot of money doing that, but it would be wrong. And that usually is the end of the conversation. So we could make a lot of money by enslaving girls, but it would be wrong. We could make a lot of money by, well, all these kinds of terrible things we could do, but it would be wrong. And I just think it's the same pattern of thinking, that we could make a lot of money by drilling in the Arctic, where we now finally have
access to the oil.
Access to the oil. But it would be wrong. And so I guess that doesn't matter.
And so how do we get beyond that it doesn't matter? Because I think that there are people who really, the bottom line for them is the bottom line financially, and there's no way to move them to this other place where they see the misfortune that's being caused. And then the other part of it are these hedge fund type people that will, on the one hand, invest in green technology, but they're going to hedge on the other things. They're also going to invest on geoengineering just so that they don't lose either way.
You know, philosophers don't know much about hedge funds, nor do academics, pardon me. But I do have faith in the rising wave of moral affirmation that I see coming across the country and across the world. People are saying, you know, causing climate change, the fossil fuel industry, is deeply violating human rights. And it's creating injustice around the world. It is a betrayal of the children. It is desacralizing the natural world, and that this can't be allowed to continue. And people say to me, oh, you know, Kathy, you're such a philosopher. What difference does it make what kind of moral affirmation people have? But I think that's a misreading of history. There was a rising wave of affirmation of the principle that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. And the great European democracies fell like dominoes. And we had the principle that all people who have been held as slaves will henceforward and forever be free. And history turned a corner. And Martin Luther King stood up and said, I have a dream. And just the words and the affirmation pushed back the snarling dogs. Hell no, I won't go. So what we need to find, I think, is the voice to affirm a different ethic than the one that seems to be controlling these profit-making enterprises.
Well, I was also listening to an interview I did with a man who is the director of an organization in Calgary called COSIA, which is basically a consortium of oil industry, oil companies, and other oil-related companies that are looking for fixes, environmental fixes for the tar sands, how to make the tar sands impact less environmentally brutal. And that's like where the faster forests come in and things like that. But he was saying that there's a growing ethic around the world that people want to be environmentally responsible. And so these companies are beholden to their consumers, basically. And so it's making them want to be more environmentally conscious. And that's why they're really driven to change their practices. And then he says, we're all part of the rising tide. And I thought, it's interesting. I wonder if he knows that there's an organization called Rising Tide, which is like really opposed to the tar sands.
And what we want to do is to hold their feet to the fire, these oil-soaked executives, and make sure that what we're not seeing is a dishonest effort to convince us that they are respecting the earth when, in fact, they're not.
Well, speaking of rising tides, we have one here at KBOO right now. It's called our Pledge Drive, and Justin's over in the other room, and we're going to remind you now why you should go to your phone and go to call 877-500-5266 and become a member of the Rising Tide of KBOO.
That's right, and a rising tide lifts all boats. 877-500-5266 to support Barbara Bernstein, Locus Focus. Remember, this is a labor of love for all of our programmers. There's one thing that they really like, and that is to make their program goal. So we divide up basically every hour of the membership drive and figure out how much we have to have. And then we come to the listenership and we say, look, this is what we need to continue serving the entire community. Remember, you're not giving it to us exactly. You're making a gift to and for the community. When you call 877-500-KBOO, you can do that online at kboo.fm, or you can come in to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. That's what Ted did. He came in from Tigard to renew his membership. We are so grateful to Ted, really pointing the way, leading the charge for so many others who are hopefully moving to their phones right now. In fact, it would be great to add some new members to the KBOO Good Book. So call up and introduce yourself right now, 877-500-5266. If you could do $60 or more, we can give you a copy of Kathleen Dean Moore's book, Moral Ground, Ethical Action for a Planet in Peril. And indeed, when we ask you to give to KBOO, we are asking you to engage in some ethical activity. Remember, stage development theory, roughly put. Stage one, you do the right thing to avoid punishment. Stage two, you do the right thing so that people will like you. And stage three, you do the right thing because it's the right thing. And I know we are speaking to a lot of stage three people right now. Call us, 877-500-KBOO.
And if you're a stage one person, we have no way of punishing you. But actually, you by your not supporting KABU, and if enough people didn't support KABU, the punishment would be that the station would be a lot weaker. So do give a call at 877-500-5266. Become a member of this great social force here in Portland that we are also proud to be part of, and I hope that you're really proud to be listening to. If you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Kathleen Dean Moore, who is an environmental philosopher and essayist, formerly a professor at Oregon State University. Now she is on the lecture circuit, book writing circuit, and activist circuit. And a lot of people actually pointed out last fall to me that she was speaking at a 350.org event, I think it was at the First Unitarian Church, to deal with climate change. Her lecture was called something about if your house is on fire. And actually somebody who I run into a lot at peace marches and environmental justice marches and things like that, she said, you have to get Kathleen Dean Moore on your show. So 6 months later, here we are. So I want to ask you about a question that I run into this when I'm at meetings and people are trying to figure out how to reach the people that have to have their minds changed if we're going to save this planet, or people that we really want to find ways to communicate with. And I was at a meeting a few months ago that was organizing protests against the megaloads, the last one which just left Umatilla last Tuesday and is on its way to through Idaho at this time, and actually left Umatilla without any protest. I think people were kind of pummeled by the bad weather last week and didn't get out there. So at this first meeting, a woman asked, how do you talk to people when they say we need the oil and that's why we have to let these trucks go through and that's why the tar sands need to be developed? And a number of people at the meeting came up with answers that I thought were a little bit glib and maybe a little self-satisfied. Well, we need clean air. We need clean water. You can say that to these people and that will convince them. But I don't think it does. So how do you answer that question?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest triumphs of big oil is to convince ourselves that we need it. Another one of their big triumphs is to convince us that we're the ones who are to blame because big oil is only responding to demand. They're not manipulating it. Well, that's not true. It is simply not true. Big oil is manipulating demand. It is reducing our options. It is doing everything it can to kill off alternative sources of energy. It's ruining the democracy in order to make the world safe for big oil. And it has spent millions and millions of dollars to confuse us about the consequences of oil. And so it seems to me that we need to be really, really clear about why we have so few choices. And I think it's very clear that the reason is that this is the business plan of big oil. Of course, everyone wants a monopoly. So, of course, it's going to be hard in the United States to find ways to make solar power, other alternatives thrive. What we clearly need is for oil and gasoline to be priced at their real cost so that we can understand that there are probably cheaper and better ways for us to power our lives than just burning everything up.
Well, I've run into this statement that several people that I've interviewed have said, they've been quoting the Pogo line, that's we have met the enemy and he is us. And everybody from this tar sands engineer that I talked with in Calgary in September to, I think I actually heard Elizabeth Colbert saying that in an interview with Amy Goodman last week. But when I talked with you a couple months ago, you had a different take on that. What is your response when people say, we've met the enemy and it's us, meaning basically we need to drive less, we need to think of ways to use energy more efficiently, that it's the consumer's fault?
Of course we should live more thoughtfully. Of course we should reduce our reliance on oil. Of course we should find alternative ways to get to work and to travel. But when big oil is externalizing all its other costs on us, all its other costs on me, I'm not going to allow it to externalize its shame. I'm not the one who cut corners and caused this gusher in the Gulf of Mexico. I'm not the one who's bribing congressmen to gut the laws that would reduce their power. It's not me. And I'm not the one who's trying to make clear that nobody else and trying to make sure that nobody else has any alternatives. So we have met the enemy, and I'm going to try really hard to make sure it isn't me. But I'm not going to allow big oil to confuse me about where the true source of the shame is.
I wonder why it is that that phrase has like come up, because I haven't heard that in years. I was one of these phrases that a lot of us grew up with, and yet somehow I feel the way it's being thrown out, that I'm curious by a lot of environmentalists who throw it out as well. I mean, the guy from who was this oil geologist that I talked to was actually very interesting, because he basically pointed out all the flaws and contradictions in our society. But then he keeps throwing it back and saying, well, these environmentalists who are against the Keystone XL pipeline, but they're driving their SUVs to go to the gym to exercise on a stationary bike. And I mean, he's making some good points about contradictions that people have. But I wonder about people who have a different agenda than this guy, whose agenda might be more closely aligned with your agenda, let's say. But they still see us as the enemy in a way.
Yeah, in our logic classes, we call that a circumstantial ad hominem argument. And it goes like this. The circumstances of your life poison your well. Because there are certain facts about how you live, we won't believe anything you say whatsoever. It is a fallacy, and we cannot allow it to be said over and over and over again, and we particularly can't say it about ourselves. Of course I don't live a perfect life. Of course Al Gore lives in a big house. All the same, the things that we say about climate change shouldn't be dismissed on that count. We're doing the best we can to free ourselves from this iron grasp of the fossil fuel industry. The fact that we haven't succeeded in living a perfect life doesn't silence us. We cannot allow it to silence us.
And how do you think that maybe we can live a closer to perfect life? I mean, if we look at the things that we're doing now, I mean, like this last couple of weeks, I've been obsessed with replacing light bulbs and getting LED light bulbs. And I'm thinking as I screw one in, this light bulb may last longer than I do. It's kind of an interesting concept. I like that one. But but that's a small thing. I mean, in fact, I hear a lot of people, particularly like people like in Rising Tide, to go, it's not enough to change your light bulbs. So besides changing our light bulbs, how else can we change our minds?
Whenever we have a massive moral failure of government, we're called to a number of things, and we know what these are. We're called to conscientious objection. We're called to saying, you know, I don't believe in that, and I will not participate. I don't believe in wasting fuel. I won't participate in that. I don't believe in importing food from a long way away, and I won't participate in that. I don't believe in poisoning the atmosphere with flatulence. I'm not going to eat beef. You know, every decision we make about how we travel and what we eat and how we educate ourselves and what we invest in defines who we are as moral people. So every time we say, yes, I believe in this, or no, I don't believe in that and I won't be part of it, we are creating new ways of defining ourselves in relationship to the challenges we face. So conscientious objection is one that we're quite used to. Civil disobedience is another one. Creative disturbance is one I really like. This notion that you don't have to stop a river in order to change its flow. You just have to chuck in enough rocks. And that the flow of the river itself will move, divide itself, slow, and actually turn upstream. So the more disturbances we can make by way of finding cheaper, more effective, more beautiful ways of living, those are disturbances to the system. Those are perturbations to the system. The more we can tell the truth, the more we can witness, those are perturbations to the system. They slow the current and turn it around. We all know what an eddy is. Portlanders are river people. We know the dynamics and the physics of a river. And we don't have to dam this river in order to change it.
Well, some of the changes that a lot of people throw out, I remember actually one of the suggestions at the end of An Inconvenient Truth was get an electric or hybrid car. And that's all well and good if you have $35,000. So there, a lot of the, and even LED light bulbs, I mean, they've come down in price, but I can see a lot of people going, I'm not going to spend $15 for a light bulb or $10 for a light bulb. So how do we make these ability to change your life available to people who don't have the same resources as people who can go out, who can afford to buy a Prius or change all their light bulbs?
Yeah, there's a couple things that I would say in response to that. One is to point out that these new technologies, these what I would call replacement technologies, replacing the fossil fuel technologies, are expensive because they're new. And the more we participate in them, the more we are allowing the investment that it's going to take to make them cheaper. So even though it's funny to think that buying a particular kind of car would help stop climate change, it might in fact encourage the development of the new kinds of batteries and technologies we need. That's one thing to say. The other is to say that the whole notion of technological solutions to our problems ignores the vast capacity we have as moral creatures to come together to find new life ways. And certainly sharing a car is better than buying one. Certainly abandoning cars altogether are better than sharing them. What we need to do, rich or poor, is demand alternatives and to make sure that the people who are trying to provide the alternatives are protected, that we need to say to them, you know, we have your back, those of you who are advocating and trying to empower alternatives.
Well, I was reading an interesting article in the New York Times the other day about this big thermal solar farm, basically, that's been built in the Mojave Desert near the Arizona-California border. And the article stated that this is probably the last one that's going to be built. I mean, this is a huge, I didn't get the square mileage of it, but it is a huge area that's just covered with solar panels, which, in my opinion, is not a great use of desert. And I remember when they were planning on building it, there was a lot of opposition within the environmental community. But the reason why they're not going to build it any more of these is that they really are too expensive and they're not that efficient. And the article is saying that they're finding that it's much more efficient to put solar panels on rooftops. Duh. So I'm hoping, I mean, that's something where I was thinking, maybe we also have to change our way of thinking about new technologies, that we move away from these industrial scale energy producers like huge wind farms, huge solar panel arrays, and we find ways to make them community-based again.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Desert's not a place for a solar array, but a schoolhouse is. A schoolyard might perhaps be. It also might be a very good place for a garden. And every neighborhood has one of these. So I think that one of the most exciting changes that we're seeing is the return toward the local community and the empowerment of the local and the joys of the local. I think you're right.
Well, I'm hoping that that's something that can really be strengthened, because, and I know that's a big movement with food, and that's another issue where right now local healthy food is more expensive to buy than food that's been grown halfway around the world and heavily processed. So, and I talked to somebody a number of years ago who said it's responsible of people who can afford to buy healthy food at the farmer's market and to buy organic food to do it, to drive down the price. So I guess that's another place we can target for those people who have the means to see it as their responsibility, their moral responsibility to consume in appropriate ways to enable ultimately other people with less means to be able to consume the same way.
And to be real careful to think hard about why that food that is so cheap is really, really, really expensive. It's expensive in the currency of human rights. It's expensive in the currency of climate change. It's expensive in the currency of environmental destruction. And to realize that that's one of the things we don't have to, quote, buy into, end quote.
Well, those are externalities. And I guess maybe we have to find some way to internalize the externalities.
Yes, in food production, of course, and also in the production of carbon.
So how do you see that happening? In a minute, 1 minute to sum up this whole thing.
I have a minute to answer the hardest question that there is.
Right.
I would say that one of the first steps is going to have to be to do it. I mean, how do you write a story? Every writer knows the answer to that. It's to write the story. It's to sit down and write a sentence and then write another sentence. And in the writing of it, its meaning and the way forward becomes clearer.
Well, Kathleen Dean Moore, it's really been wonderful to be talking with you. And we are going to now talk some more with Justin about why you need to become a member of KBOO and to help bring our to reach our goal, which I believe is $500. Is that right, Justin?
It's $500. We still have a few hundred dollars to go and a couple of phone lines open. And so we're inviting listeners to support this valuable program. I'm not going to say if you support it, because you're listening and you have been listening. You've been listening to Barbara Bernstein and Locus Focus for quite some time. That doesn't make her old. That makes her experienced. And her work in civic engagement and politics and environment and regionalism, these are vital, vital things to have available to the community. And it happens, listeners, because you answer the call by making the call to 877-500-5266. You can do that online at kboo.fm, or you can come down and meet us in person at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. $60 or more gets you a copy of Moral Ground by Kathleen Dean Moore and Michael P. Nelson. I've really been enjoying this interview, and it reminded me of something we often try and remind the listeners, that like it or not, how we spend our money in this day and age in a society like this says something about the life we intend to live. And dear listeners, here's that ethical component a bit. Giving just a small amount of money to KBOO is taking a stand towards sustainable, towards informative, towards educational, towards free access to the public airwaves. Won't you call right now and do that? 877-500-KBOO. I think I still have exactly one pair of tickets to see Arlo Guthrie on April 16th at the Aladdin Theater, if you could start a membership of $120 today. It's our winter membership drive, and now is the time where our listeners have the opportunity to call up and introduce themselves and to give us a little feedback on how we're doing, what we can do better, what drove them to support community radio. Why don't you call up and tell us right now? 877-500-5266. This is a labor of love for Barbara Bernstein and for all of our cultural and political ambassadors, as I like to call them, who spend their time digging up information, reading books, lining up interviews, and they come in and they bring it to you. Who knew that we could give this all away for free and just ask people in radio land to put a small price on it and call us up? It actually is working for 23 million commercial free minutes and counting. That's worth a little support, dear listeners. 877-500-5266. Never have such small, modest contributions had such a resounding impact. Think of the thousands of people that have come through KBOO's hallowed halls and received training and become citizen journalists, have furthered the course of activism, whether that's battling against climate change or battling against social injustice or environmental degradation. There are so many different things that are covered by our ambassadors. Every hour of every day, music, news you're not supposed to know, we give away tickets, we have bands in the studio, so many reasons. We know, dear listeners, you give for your reasons, not for ours, but I believe we have given many, many reasons, and we hope that you'll think about that right now as you move to your phone. 877-500-5266, or you can do that online at kboo.fm. Barbara, you have been doing this for quite some time, and you do other forms of citizen journalism as well.
Well, when I'm not doing this show, I'm busy either creating radio documentaries or also working on a film documentary right now. And those are a little bit more lucrative than doing Locus Focus. Actually, not that much more, as it seems these days. But it's I do this show because I really believe in it, and because, well, for one thing, it gets me connected with all kinds of amazing people, like Kathleen Dean Moore, who I probably wouldn't have connected with if I weren't doing this show, and with Mackenzie Funk, who I had on last week, who wrote the book Windfall. And so I get to really talk to interesting people, and I get to bring these conversations to you. And that's what KBOO is all about, is allowing those of us who are on the air to share our passions and to share our experiences and our knowledge and our contacts with a really wider audience, and to get you engaged as well, and to introduce to you people that we've connected with and who excite us. And we would like to share your excitement right now by having you give us a call at 877-500-5266, or you can join online by going to kboo.fm, click on the tip jar and become a member. And as Justin's mentioned, for a $60 pledge, you can get a copy of Kathleen Dean Moore's book that she wrote with Michael Nelson, called Moral Ground, Ethical Action for a Planet in Peril, which is like a very hefty book full of very short essays by all kinds of people, from David James Duncan, Terry Tempest Williams, to Desmond Tutu. It's quite an interesting array of people. Barack Obama's in there also, as I recall.
Early Barack Obama.
Yeah, who said a good thing. Barack Obama made a comment I read yesterday that maybe we can apply to this pledge drive, which was that in California, with the water shortage, which he's attributing to climate change, people have to change their attitudes and not think that a water shortage means you grab more for yourself. It's time to figure out how to make it all go around more fairly. And that's what CAPE was about, too, is to make things go around more fairly. We want to find ways to help shift a paradigm in this world where the resources of the world, the accessibility to everything that's good in life, is shared equitably, that we really break down the social inequality and the access inequality that is marring our civilization right now. So KABU is a great leveler, a great force of democracy, and you can help to strengthen that by calling 877-500-5266. Any last words, Justin?
Well, I was just going to remind people of that phone number and remind them that we're making all of these programming decisions not based on commercial viability, not based on shrieking heads, but about community needs. And I think today has been a perfect example of that. And we're hoping that in this last few seconds of the program, a few more people will call up and introduce themselves. Toll free, 877-500-5266.
Thank you, Justin. Well, this morning we've been talking with environmental philosopher and essayist Kathleen Dean Moore, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KABU Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week we'll be talking about Senator Ron Wyden's plan to double logging levels on publicly owned Bureau of Land Management lands in Western Oregon, and my guest will be Dominic Della Sala with the Geos Institute in Ashland. My engineer is Joe Clement. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Joni Mitchell. Thanks for listening, and keep supporting the Pledge Drive.
You are tuned to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. The time is 11 o'clock. And up next is Health Watch with Dr. David Naiman. This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Redirect Guide, committed to promoting progressive regional businesses based on the values of sustainability, localism, and social justice. Complete business directory and resource guide at redirectguide.com.
The purpose of this program is not to prescribe a treatment to individuals. Listeners should consult their healthcare practitioner before attempting any treatment.
Good morning and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Today's guest, Amy Doning, is co-founder and medical director of the Heart Attack and Stroke Prevention Center in Spokane, Washington. She's a professor at Texas Tech Health Science Center's School of Nursing, and she's here today to talk about her new book, co-authored with Dr. Bradley Bale, Beat the Heart Attack Gene, the Revolutionary Plan to Prevent Heart Disease, Stroke, and Diabetes. Welcome to Health Watch, Amy Doning.
Thank you so much for having me. Glad to be here.
So one of the first takeaway messages from Beat the Heart Attack Gene is that our listeners could be out there thinking that they are at low risk for heart attacks and strokes because they have normal blood pressure and normal cholesterol, but in fact, some of them could be at very high risk for those conditions, even with those normal values. Can you explain that a little bit?
I sure can. Yeah, and you're exactly right. We oftentimes the standard of care, which is what the current medical system is founded upon, is so heavily based on cholesterol management and blood pressure management, which is one aspect of a much bigger pie, if you will, that causes plaque growth in the walls of the artery. So people who are even treated for cholesterol and blood pressure still may find themselves at risk for a vascular event, whether it be a heart attack or an ischemic stroke. What we aim to demonstrate in this book is this book is aimed at the public, and we talk about what we call the root causes of vascular disease. There's lots of reasons why we develop plaque in the walls of the arteries. Cholesterol is one of them. Blood pressure is one of them. But other things like periodontal disease, obstructive sleep apnea, psychosocial issues, yes, lifestyle factors as well, nicotine, genetically driven factors also can drive plaque growth. So understanding what the root causes are really allow us to know our true risk for the development of plaque and places at risk for heart attack or stroke.
Well, it's really interesting, Amy, the section you have about red flags, the things that could put you at more risk for heart attacks and strokes, some of which people probably don't know about. If you have psoriasis, if you get frequent migraines, if you have a vitamin D deficiency. But what are some of the ones that you would rank near the top of red flags that are not cholesterol and blood pressure?
Yeah, so red flags don't always have a direct cause and effect, meaning if we correct the red flag, it doesn't mean your risk is going to completely go away. But red flags definitely have the data to support there's an association, that if you have one of these things, there's data to support that you have an elevated risk for the development of a potential heart attack or stroke. So the red flags that are most causative and the most concerning are those that create an inflammatory backdrop in our arterial system. So things like rheumatoid arthritis, psoriasis, which you mentioned. For women, women have a lot of clues that are often ignored, sadly. Things like hypertension during pregnancy, or even that continuing, and you get a condition called preeclampsia, polycystic ovarian syndrome, gestational diabetes, migraine with aura, on medical history. All of those are, yes, what we call red flags. And if anyone has any of those, they should consider themselves potentially at risk, and they should get a full assessment.
And a full assessment meaning not just a cholesterol, blood sugar, and blood pressure assessment, but you actually suggest quite a few other tests that are less commonly prescribed.
We do. So the approach that we discuss in the book is really a three-aspect approach. So the first thing is to find out if you have plaque or inflammation in the wall of the artery. And there's tests that we talk about in the book. One that is kind of a workhorse tool for us is called the carotid intima media thickness test. And this test is an ultrasound test. It's very safe. It's been around for a long time. It's been backed by the American Heart Association since 2001 as a safe, reliable, reproducible test.